From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Alexa Simondigger, White House correspondent for Real Clear Politics, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton advanced toward the Republican and Democratic presidential nominations as they scored decisive wins in primaries in several northeastern states. Trump, in an effort to appear more presidential, delivered a foreign policy address that promised to, quote, put America first, unquote, and defeat the Islamic State, but he offered few specifics. And two major oil-producing countries, Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, face uncertain futures as their revenues decline. Saudi Arabia announced a sweeping new economic vision, Saudi Arabia 2030, meant to wean the country off its dependence on oil and promote private enterprise. Well, we're going to start with domestic affairs for a change, Alexis. This was the week that it appeared that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump sewed up their respective nominations. Is there anything that can stop them now?
Well, this was an amazing week on the Republican side. It started off with this hoped-for alliance between the two candidates who represent the never-Trump hopes. You know, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, and then Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. That alliance fell apart within hours, and that's the way the week started off, and it got more raucous as the week went on. And of course, we know that Donald Trump, as you say, made a clean sweep of the five Atlantic northeastern states in which he hoped to do well. The polls suggested that he would win, but he won so decisively that it really stopped the Never Trump movement almost in its tracks. So that alliance that I mentioned then morphed into Senator Cruz trying to build a new alliance by picking a vice presidential running mate even before and way distant from being a nominee in a last-ditch hope to head towards Indiana, which is next week, where Donald Trump is also leading in the polls, hoping to persuade conservatives to support him. Hillary Clinton, as you mentioned, really is now the nominee for the Democratic Party, and her competitor, Senator Bernie Sanders, has done everything to indicate that he understands this is the case, although he will compete all the way into June in California to defend a platform and agenda more than to defend the, you know, competition for the nomination.
Yeah. David, the Cruz maneuver, we talk about Hail Mary passes in football, but this was a Hail Carly. How does picking Carly Fiorina help him at all in his, I mean, it's now mathematically impossible, right, for him to win a nomination, at least on a first ballot.
That's right. So if you were in the kind of Cruz bunker, looking for ways out, you say, oh, great, you know, there's this woman, Carly Fiorina. She was reasonably successful early on in the campaign. She's a woman, so that, you know, adds some balance to the ticket. Maybe it helps with women voters who are upset by the sort of sexist and misogynistic things that Donald Trump says. She ran for the Senate in California. That's the last kind of big prize coming up in June. So why not give it a go? The problem is, if you're not in the Cruz bunker, if you're actually in the kind of the real universe that everyone else inhabits, Carly Fiorina wasn't a very successful presidential candidate. She was a disastrous Senate candidate. She's not very popular in California. She's not very likable. I mean, she's likable in person. I've interviewed her, but she's pretty shrill and kind of doctrinaire on the stump. And so given that Cruz's big problem is that he's pretty shrill and doctrinaire on the stump, they don't really add much to each other's campaign.
We found out she can sing.
We found out that she can sing, but so could the Wicked Witch of the West. So that's, you know, that's not so great. Why are we still obsessing about these races? I think it's important to remind listeners that the way that the Republicans and the Democrats, but we're really interested in the Republicans still, the way that they'll pick their candidate to run for the White House, the decision will be taken at this big meeting in July where the whole national party comes together for a national convention. And mostly, in all previous years since 1976, that was a foregone conclusion. It was a coronation, not a contest, because the candidate coming into that convention had won so many delegates in these state-by-state races that they were going to win the first ballot automatically because they had a majority of the delegates. The thing about Donald Trump is that he's basically trying to carry out a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. And if you're carrying out a hostile takeover of any organization, you've basically got one shot at that.
Right.
You get it on the first shot or you don't get it. And so if he can get enough delegates that he just has a majority – then the party has no choice. They have to make him their candidate when they meet in July at their big convention. But there is a sense out there, and I think there's a lot to this, that if he is short of a majority, if he arrives at the convention and it goes to a second or a third round of voting, an awful lot of the kind of people, the party loyalists who go to these conventions, they will perhaps try and look elsewhere. You know, he has one real shot at this. So he still has to try and get to that magic number, which is a majority of delegates. So we're unexpectedly excited by the Indiana primary next Tuesday. The Indiana primary is not usually a red letter news day, but it counts, because if Trump wins that, then really, you know, he is on course to pick up a majority. But it's tight. I mean, he can't make many mistakes. He can't lose many states between now and the big prize in California.
Yeah. Well, Alexis, he was obviously helped by some comments that John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, had about Ted Cruz. Some of them we can't repeat on the air, but what did he call him? He called him Lucifer
in the flesh. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Sounds like a song, doesn't it? Yes. One of the things that David mentioned that I think is really important to remember is that it may be a hostile takeover that Donald Trump has tried to wage. But what has happened to the also-rans is that Senator Ted Cruz has inspired a lot of hostility and, you know, negative feelings in the party itself. So one of the things that has really helped Donald Trump is, at this point, now that he's looking like he is winning the popular vote state after state and could do very well in Indiana, in New Jersey, in California, still ahead, is that the alternatives to Donald Trump are not well embraced or liked by the party, which is emblematic of what it was that former Speaker Boehner called him. And the bitterness that the former speaker is representing is from inside Washington. The party inside Washington despises Ted Cruz because of his maneuvers and his gambits that he waged while as a senator to the shutdown of the government. And of course, we know that Speaker Boehner in some ways blames Ted Cruz for losing the speakership. So in this case, one of the things the polls showed after the five states that Donald Trump won is exit polling suggests that the party is feeling less hostile to Donald Trump because they're so leery of what David described, which is this free-for-all fracas meltdown in Cleveland at the convention. And all of a sudden, Donald Trump is becoming slightly more appealing by the hour, you know, to even the elites of the party.
It's amazing. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin with Alexis Simmendinger and David Rennie. David, with the results of the primaries that we now have, it does appear that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are kind of pivoting toward the general election. I wanted to bring up one other thing that Donald Trump said and that Hillary, in a way, responded to before we get to Donald Trump's foreign policy speech, and that is this whole notion of playing the woman's card. Donald Trump said that if Hillary Clinton were a man, she would not be a successful candidate at all. And Hillary has embraced this and said, well, if, you know, caring about equal pay for equal work and so on and health care or playing the women's card, you know, deal me in. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, I think that in the short term, you can see both of them thinking there's an advantage to this. I mean, if you look at who are Donald Trump's most loyal supporters at the moment, it's white men without, you know, college education. And so in as much as one of the many things they have a grievance about, whether it's competition from Chinese workers or uppity African Americans who no longer know their place after civil rights, one of the things they have a grievance about is their economic value as men is less because women enter the workforce and actually, in many cases, have more economic value in the kind of places where they live than the men who used to work in factories do. So there is a real strain of kind of misogyny in the Trump movement. You can see it if you go to Trump rallies, as I do. Just look at the badges that people sell outside to buy for themselves. You know, there's a really vile strain of sexism directed at Hillary, all about, you know, the idea that a woman is, you know, automatically kind of shrewish and anti-men and all those things, and, you know, vile language and sort of very sort of sexual overtones. The truth is, though, that actually Hillary does play the woman card all the time. I think some of the worst moments in the Democratic debates when Hillary Clinton was debating Bernie Sanders was when she got into a tight spot very often she would accuse Bernie Sanders of sexism, effectively. And she would do that several times, which is outrageous, because Bernie Sanders is not a sexist. But she would do this thing when, you know, he would say, you know, well, you took all this money from big Wall Street banks, that to my mind makes you a member of the establishment. And she would say, well, only Senator Sanders could think that a woman is a member of the establishment. Yeah, you know, a woman, you know, a woman running for the presidency, how can that possibly be establishment? You know, as if Bernie Sanders was making a sexist point when he wasn't. So she is perfectly willing to play the woman card.
Yeah.
That's true. The problem Donald Trump has is that Hillary Clinton is also perfectly at liberty to turn that round and use it to make him look like the sexist that he is. So the moment they're both feeding off each other.
Yeah. What do you think? How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, you know, in the world that I occupy and the way I look at the general election, I'm trying to think how this will really help Donald Trump expand the group of voters that he so dearly wants to attract to defeat Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee. And I think that we saw right away when this, you know, volley was going back and forth on Tuesday night, that you could see even the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie's wife, standing behind on the television screen, Donald Trump, who was giving this victory speech. And she shifted her eyes as if it was someone had just handed her something, you know, malodorous to deal with. And that's the kind of reaction that Donald Trump can prompt, even in Republican, conservative, potentially independent. These are women voters that beyond his Republican base that he would need in order to win in November. And so the calculus to me is a little mysterious, right?
Yeah.
But he is going to keep at it. David is absolutely right. It appeals very much to the base of support he has now, but that's not what he needs later.
Yeah. And it's really interesting that if you look at so we talk often about the gender gap. So for many, many, many years, men have broadly voted more Republican than Democrat, and women have voted more Democrat than Republican. But if you break it down, it's really interesting. Actually, the real gender gap is unmarried women break for Democrats by like 20 points in 2012 in the presidential election. Married women actually broke for the Republicans by about 1 or 2 points at the last presidential election. So married women are a group that Republicans need to win. And if you're looking at, you know, most places in this country are not swing states. Most places in this country are basically locked in place. So political reporters like us, come election time, there's a rather small list of places that we look to see which way they're swinging. So we look at places like the suburban counties around Philadelphia, the suburban counties around Denver in Colorado, and some of the most important swing voters, the people who really do genuinely go from one party to the other, depending on the election, are suburban mums with kids at school who are worried
about schools.
Soccer
mums, we used to call them.
Yeah. These people are genuine swing voters, and Republicans have done much better with them than they have with most other groups of women, like women of color or unmarried women. So for Donald Trump to be throwing all women away, which the numbers suggest he is at the moment, is another reason why a thoughtful Republican has their head in their hands, because they nominate Trump, they're going to lose.
Let's move on from women to foreign policy, if we may. Trump gave a speech in front of the Center for the National Interest, which is a kind of realist, old-school think tank in Washington that came out of the Nixon administration, sort of the Kissinger-Nixon view of the world, very hard-nosed. It was an interesting choice for Trump. He gave a speech. He talked about putting America first. He talked about trying again with the Russians. What did you make of it, Alexis?
Well, you listened to the speech and your head started to spin because it was internally inconsistent, right? And maybe we could talk about some of those things. But one of the things that struck me was this idea that we need to build up a more ferocious and respected military armature. And yet then later in the speech, he talked about the riskiest thing around the world is weaponry.
That was not in the transcript. He kind of threw that in. I also scratched my head because at one point he talked about how we have to spend more on modernizing nuclear weapons. And then he says that weapons are the most dangerous, the biggest problem that we have. So, you know, which part of his brain did that come from?
Right. And then, you know, there was also commentary that where did his ambition for the wall and his concern about refugees and immigration go? It's in the speech. It's just not as hardly, I guess, punctuated. But then the rally he had right afterwards, the rally he's had that created some uprising in California, he went right back at
to
immigration, right back to the wall. So it wasn't in front of this
very esteemed audience with the teleprompters. It was in there in the speech, but then he came right back at it when he was free associating in a normal kind of rally.
David, did you get any better sense of what a President Trump would do in foreign policy from this speech?
Well, I mean, no, that wasn't what the speech was for. I mean, as a piece of foreign policy, it was junk. I mean, that was, you know, it was ridiculous. But as a piece of politics, it was great. It was really, really smart. Look, the audience in Washington, the former ambassadors, the ex-generals, the professors, the people who advise traditional presidential candidates, you know, the stripy trouser brigade who inhabit all the think tanks on Massachusetts Avenue.
Please, I inhabit a think tank.
They sneer at that sort of speech. They think it was ridiculous. They think it was incoherent. You know, he talks about the Middle East on the one hand as this quagmire that America should stay a million miles away from. On the other hand, easily fixed. He has a secret plan to defeat the Islamic State, like Nixon's secret plan to end the Vietnam War. And it was so secret he couldn't tell us what it was because that would tip his hand, but they were going to be gone, you know, immediately.
Yeah.
So simultaneously a quagmire and easy to fix. But here's the thing. I think the politics were really smart because who's he speaking to? He's speaking to a group of people, and in many cases they're from the kind of communities which send their sons and daughters into the army to fight and die in these wars. The last 15 years have been tough on them. They sent their kids to these wars, and basically America didn't win. And that doesn't feel good. These people do not like to feel that their children died in vain. Who would? And one of the most painful issues for the Republicans has been how to handle this legacy, that it was their president, President Bush, who started these wars, and they didn't win. And how do you explain that? And you can explain that in the stripy trouser way, in the think tank way, and say, well, the world is more complicated than we realized, and there were unintended consequences, and we failed to do planning. Donald Trump cuts through all of that, and he says they were betrayed. Good, heroic America was betrayed by its callous, incompetent elites. That our problem was we were too nice, too good, and we need to be tougher and meaner and more selfish, and then everything will come right. And that's really smart politics.
Time for another break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Welcome back. I'm Barbara Slavin with David Rennie and Alexis Simmendinger. I think maybe just one more word on the Trump speech before we move on. There was another point where he talked about how, you know, he's going to negotiate better deals, Alexis, with countries like China. And he threatened the Chinese, with whom we do have a trade deficit, but of course they have a lot of our bonds and whatnot. And he said, well, if we can't reach a better deal, we'll just go our separate ways. Is it humanly possible for the United States to go its separate way from China?
If it is, I did not hear the explanation of how that would occur from Donald Trump. And I'm not sure how the audience listening to the speech could have imagined. You know, he talked about and has talked in the past about that he knows the Chinese, has a good relationship with the Chinese. You know, they're so crafty. He understands that he can, you know, get to the table and get a better deal. But he didn't exactly describe what that is or how that would be. And then also we haven't talked about his love affair with Russia, that he has this wonderful bromance going with Vladimir Putin, you know, or just Russia. And he just thinks, oh, you know, this is going to be great. So the whole element of the speech in terms of his choice of describing the great global powers and how Donald Trump would wrestle them, why they don't respect us, us meaning the United States. In parts of it, David says it's artful. Parts of it I thought were comical.
But he also pronounced Tanzania, Tanzania. We can't let that go.
Yeah, but don't forget, that was then played to his benefit because Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, then sent out a tweet saying, you know, all the smarty pants criticizing him for saying Tanzania, he pronounced the word America right, and that's the one that counts, and you guys don't get it. But that's how people think outside Washington.
All right.
You know, and just one final thing on the Trump speech. I think the single biggest weakness of it is exactly as Alexis says. He described running foreign policy as though it's a series of real estate deals, that you go to a particular client and you haggle over the table, and then if you don't get a good deal,
you
he said repeatedly,
yeah,
you know, to get a good deal, you have to be willing to walk away. Anyone who has watched presidents or prime ministers conduct foreign policy know that it's actually like a fire hose that is in your face 24 hours a day. You don't pick and choose deals that you can go and visit the other side, talk to them and walk away. It's a constant fire hose of events that you have to handle. So that kind of understanding of the world is complete nonsense. But why does Donald Trump not care? Because the people in this town who know better also totally messed up the last 15 years. The foreign policy elites of this country have zero credibility because their expertise brought them no advantage. They led America into disaster. That's how most Americans think. So all of us sitting in this town, no one's listening to us because we have no credibility out in
the I hope somebody's listening to us elsewhere. But I want to turn to a couple of items that really caught my interest this week, and they have to do with two oil-producing countries that are very, very reliant on oil. Trump did sort of allude to Saudi Arabia when he mentioned that Obama was not, you know, greeted by King Salman himself when he was on a recent trip to Saudi Arabia. But I mean, there are much bigger issues that Trump did not touch. Saudi Arabia is burning through $100 billion a year in reserves as it tries to maintain living standards despite the low price of oil. Now they've unveiled this huge new blueprint called Saudi Vision 2030. David, can they really change the way the country is run? Are they just going to sell off part of Saudi Aramco, take the money, invest it, and hope to live on the dividends? I mean, what's going on?
Well, if you take it at its face value, they want to turn themselves into Norway. They're going to have a giant sort of sovereign wealth fund fed by oil money, and they're going to wean themselves off oil when the oil runs out and turn themselves into a kind of advanced manufacturing, diversified economy. So they're going to turn themselves into Norway with sand. But here's the problem is they don't have a Norwegian population. They have a population of Saudis who are incredibly badly educated, who've grown up expecting to get a job for life from the government, which you don't actually have to do. You don't have to go to your office. You just get paid. And in the meantime, you ship in foreign migrant workers who do all the real work in Saudi Arabia. So as an economy, it's totally non-functioning. Why do we give this potentially more chance of something happening, not that it's going to work, but something happening, is we have a new leader in waiting who seems to be pulling some of the reins. So all of these initiatives, the front man for these is Prince Mohammed bin Salman. We think 30. He's about 30 years old, we don't know for sure, who is the second in line to the throne. His father is the king, King Salman, who doesn't seem to be a very active executive. He's not well. There is a crown prince, his uncle. We don't know how much power this young sort of feisty prince actually has. We also don't know, when King Salman dies, whether this young guy, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, is going to just be out on his ear or whether he really does have power. But he's certainly shaking up the machine. He's doing stuff as defense minister as well that's very, very out of the kind of the norm. So everyone is waiting to see. You've got this young, impatient prince who isn't the first in line to the throne. He's only the second in line to the throne. And we don't know how secure his position is. But yeah, he's saying all these big things.
Yeah. Alexis, if you read this vision statement, they're talking about attracting investment, foreign investment and so on. As David pointed out, Saudi Arabia is not Norway. Women can't drive. There are severe restrictions on religious practices. If you're a foreign woman or any kind of woman in the country, you have to dress in a certain way. There's no open consumption of alcohol. It doesn't sound like a very attractive place. He even talked about making it a hub for trade between Europe and the Middle East and Asia. But there's already a hub like that. It's called Dubai. So why is this suddenly going to attract folks?
Well, in terms of the discussion of what's possible, one of the elements that is really interesting, although it seems very vaguely described by the prince, is what is the non-petroleum base of the economy that he's talking about growing? There's been some suggestion that maybe tourism is something in his mind, right? Which is a fascinating idea. But you would have to imagine, as you describe, all these barriers to a Western sensibility arriving into the country. I mean, it's possible, but it doesn't seem immediate, right? And he has talked, you know, in some open terms about women, small businesses, education for women. But we're not ready to have them drive, right?
He says he wants to increase women's participation in the workforce from 22% to 30%. That's a fairly modest goal, it seems. And yeah, it doesn't suggest that they're going to get all sorts of new freedoms. But that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Alexis Simondinger, White House correspondent for Real Clear Politics, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski, and our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.